Really, his eyes, his nice dark grey ones, not the strange blue ones with flecks. But almost immediately after closing them, he turned his head and sneezed violently, shuddered with the same violence, pulled his hand away and said, "What? What is that?"
"You just met God," said Pyrrha.
"I didn't like him," said Palamedes.
"God's preserving her, or God created her, or both. Good luck seeing anything through that. His aptitude's like a punch in the nose, Sextus. Once he gets his fingers on something, he'll never find any other fingerprints on it. Too much noise."
But Crown's exquisite face had puckered again.
"But that was the whole point. When Blood of Eden picked her up, that was why they thought she was strange. Gideon never showed any sign of decomposing. She was always like a corpse that had been dead for only minutes. They wrapped her in plex and dropped her in rivers, trying to see if that would do anything. I was there. It was awful at first," she added. "And then it simply started being very funny."
"Shh, Judith, I'm here."
The captain had started fussing again. Crown, distracted, moved to her side. She said tenderly, "If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be in all this trouble. You thorn, you pest." But the captain subsided, merely jiggling her arms and her legs. Palamedes said,
"This may well be what's keeping Nona out, too. Doesn't matter. We have to operate on the basis that she really is Gideon Nav. First, lift her head so I can reach her neck. Let's make sure Ianthe can't transfer to her again, whatever happens. Surely I'm good enough for a simple ghost ward. Come, I'll use your blood. It's the one resource we've got basically sprayed around the room."
"I can give you some more," said Camilla. "There's a spoonful left somewhere in here."
"Camilla Hecht," said Palamedes. "I would slap you. Except Nibiria's turn trying to slap you would force me to kick my own ass."
They rolled the corpse prints over. Palamedes sketched some squiggles onto the back of her neck with the pad of Ianthe Nibirius's littlest finger, using Cam's bloodied clothes as a kind of paint box. He did this very carefully, then started fanning his hand to dry the mark. Camilla said, "Warden, do we continue?"
"Yes. We get the oversight body. Then we get out of here."
Crown said, "But the shuttle..."
"Oversight body, then the shuttle," said Palamedes. "Master Archivist Juno Zeta is pretty damn good with wards. She'll probably have 10 ideas I never thought of once she rips through all the ideas I have."
This did not appear to fully convince Crown.
"But even if we get the shuttle working, what next?"
"The sixth house installation," said Camilla, and Palamedes finished.
"We join up with the rest of the sixth. We get the necromancers out of this system and out of the halo. We find some way to lure the resurrection beast away from this planet so that the population gets some breathing room, while at the same time safeguarding it from any more house strong-arming. We fix Nona. We stop the war, we sue for peace, and we go to the ninth house and we begin the real fight."
Nona found that all eyes were on her. She looked around, in case there was someone behind her that everyone was actually looking at. But it was just her. She did not know what the ninth house was. Nobody she knew had more than one house. Honesty barely had a quarter house. She did not know what the ninth house was, and yet her teeth were chattering quite apart from herself, and she had to clench her jaw very hard to make them stop. This made everyone look away, which annoyed her because the way they moved their faces was pure pity. Palamedes started heaving the corpse over to lie on its back again. Camilla tried to approach and help, but he shooed her away. And once rolled, it lay there awkwardly, splayed, its clothes and sword in disarray. He said in obvious satisfaction,
"There. That'll be a first barrier to stop her doing any kind of revenant transfer. Now, Cam, pass me the syringe."
Camilla rootled around in the medical kit that Crown had brought in and retrieved a big needle. She removed the webbing from around it,
Ampyra said, Sextus, don't think I haven't thought about this. If a blood sample was going to be enough, I would have said to do it first thing. Arohark Nonagesimus couldn't have rolled aside that damned rock unless it was fresh out of the vet.
You never know, said Palamedes calmly.
Look at her. Her colour's even. There's no trace of dehydration or gravity acting on the internal fluids. If you examine the wounds, they look clean and cauterized. I can probably get a decent sample. Even if the blood survives outside the body, we'll need to take her along as a backstop.
If it survives outside the body, it'll tell us something really interesting, said Palamedes.
I'm going to puncture the femoral sheath. Camilla passed him a little pair of scissors, and he cut a short slit in the thigh of the corpse's soft leather trousers. Then Palamedes prodded around with his fingers. He placed the needle to the dead skin, and the corpse's hand shot out and ringed around his wrist before anyone could stop it. Nona noticed that one of the corpse prince's sleeves had worked up, and that on her wrist was a funny fat bracelet, a braided cord of many colours, none of which matched.
One, that's not going to work. Two, I fucking hate needles, said the corpse. Three, sex, pal. If that's how you get a lady's pants off, holy shit, no wonder I stole your girl.
Palamedes rocked back on his heels.
Not my girl. Unlike some of us, I've never much seen the allure of an evil cougar, he said crisply.
Good morning, Gideon.
25. Pyrrha's gun made a fast ka-clunk. She hadn't pointed it at anyone exactly, but it was in both her hands and her arms had tensed.
Back up, Sextus, she said.
Who's that? Said the corpse, not letting go of Palamedes' wrist. She craned her neck to one side.
Oh, hey, long time no drown. You're the one who bragged about spading my mum.
Anyone who spaded your mum would brag about it, said Pyrrha.
Ninth, said Crown, sounding almost nervous. Pyrrha ignored her and said,
He brought you back. He's made a revenant out of you.
Yup,
said the corpse prince.
But that's impossible. He shouldn't have been able to separate you. Your girl didn't manage full fusion, but what she took from you not even John could have got back, and he didn't bring you back all the way. He brought you back like this.
Sextus, if you don't put that needle away, I'm going to break Nibiris's fucking arm, said the corpse irritably.
I can't, Palamedes said. You're still holding on to my wrist.
Oh, yeah. If I let go of your wrist, you have to not stick me with the needle and then run for it, okay?
How exactly do you think blood samples work?
Please, said Crown. I'm so confused. You're actually the ninth. Gideon, the ninth. You're, what, alive?
The corpse let go of Palamedes' wrist. He withdrew his arm, still holding the needle, and sat back on his heels. The corpse levered herself up into a sitting position, then braced her arm against the floor and scrambled upright with surprising ease. She dusted off the thighs of her trousers. What shocked Nona was not that the corpse moved, it was the way in which she moved. Nona was so distracted that she couldn't stop watching. She had never seen anyone move like that before.
Nope and nope, she said. I'm Prince Kiriona Gaia I, Her Divine Highness, First Lieutenant of the Cohort, Emperor's Lifeguards Non-Auxiliary. Honorary title, but who cares? Heir to the Emperor Divine, First of the Tower Princes. And I'm mega dead.
John, you mad bastard, said Pyrrha softly.
She hadn't taken either hand off her gun.
Heir to the Emperor Divine, said Crown.
Kiriona, said Camilla. I mean, it's fine. You can call me Gideon if you want, said Prince Kiriona Gaia I. I kind of keep forgetting it's me when people say Kiriona. Anyway, who've we got?
She glanced round the group with interest.
Corona, looking great, Mum, may I say, Cam? Though probably not for long by the looks of it. Mum fucker prime, Judith Deuteros for some reason, or, like her corpse, and sex pal. Oh, and this fake Nona Jesimus over here. She paused. Everyone but Corona can leave. How come your ambulance, Sextus? Thought you went bang.
How long have you been awake? Asked Palamedes, standing up with noticeably more difficulty than the corpse prince had done.
Whole time. I've been playing possum. Pretty clever, right?
Nona was indignant enough at Prince Kirionagaya's whole demeanour, but this last piece of self-congratulation was too much to bear.
I knew it, she burst out. You didn't fool me. I saw you looking at me back in the other room. You know, when I...
Yes, congratulations, said the prince sarcastically. No baby cakes, I didn't fool you. Who is this literal goddamn infant? Can someone give her like a rascal something and shut her up?
Nona opened her mouth to say the worst thing she had ever said. She didn't know quite what it was going to be, but she understood that when it emerged, it would be really bad, perhaps the worst thing anyone had ever said. She could feel it bubbling in her throat. But Palamedes shot her a beseeching glance and she forced her jaw to clamp shut.
Nona, sorry, but hold on, said Palamedes. This isn't making as much sense as I'd like it to, and we're short on time. Nav, why did Ianthe lock you away in the first place if you're moving under your own steam?
Oh, she got big pissed that I came along for the ride, said Gideon. She shut me off in public so I wouldn't screw up the very important Sixth House mission.
She made a sort of insulting noise by blowing air out very fast through almost closed lips, like, pfft.
The ride, said Palamedes.
Wait,
you mean you both dropped through the river? In that shuttle?
Can't be, said Pyrrha, who was watching the prince narrowly. Not anymore. You've got a soul attached to you, kid, or part of one at least. John would have had to go with you to stop it being stripped bare.
The corpse prince tilted her head to one side like a curious bird.
You haven't been in the river lately, have you? She said.
What's that meant to mean?
Guess you'll find out at some point, said the prince. Anyway, you're going to the Ninth House, right? I want in.
Why? Said Camilla.
The prince shrugged.
Why not?
Nostalgia. Boy, how I miss the old place. There's no skeleton like a home skeleton, you know. I have so many happy memories there.
Nav, said Palamedes levelly,
if you've been awake this whole time, you know perfectly well what we're doing. Given that you've introduced yourself as Prince Kirionagaya the First, should you not be trying to stop us in the Emperor's name?
Prince Kirionagaya smiled. It was not a very friendly smile. It went slowly up her face, and there was something a little bit hungry about it.
Oh, sex pal, she said.
Do you want to fight me?
No, said Palamedes, at the same time moving one hand up and to the side to stop Camilla, who had taken a first step forward.
I very much don't. I've already fought one of the so-called Tower Princes today. Besides that, I consider you a friend of mine.
This filled Nona with vague outrage. She could not believe that someone as kind as Palamedes could be friends with someone as awful as Kirionagaya.
But I'm struggling to understand why you're here, what you're doing, what you want out of this.
What do you want, Gideon?
The corpse prince considered this.
I don't want much of anything anymore, she said brightly. I just don't really give a shit. I got on Ianthe's shuttle because it looked like it was more fun than standing around at home watching parades and getting saluted. I could kill all you guys and John would probably give me another medal or something. Okay, not you, Corona. Ianthe would never shut up about it, but... medals. I want to go where stuff's happening. And I feel like I've got unfinished business on the ninth. Very cultural, very personal.
She's lying, said Nona instantly. With all the white noise coming from the corpse prince,
She couldn't tell exactly where the lie was, but it was buried deep around her smile.
I thought I told you to shut your stolen goddamn mouth, said Kiriona, not pleasantly, and Camilla said, Don't push it, Ninth.
Nona's heart fluttered. It didn't even matter when Kiriona said,
Sure, Cam, marry a moron, then die. I get the urge.
Palamedes repeated very patiently,
What do you want, Gideon?
The corpse prince didn't turn an eyelash.
I want to go back. Who cares about my reasons?
That didn't look like a lie. Crown looked at Nona. Nona shrugged. Crown looked desperately at Palamedes. Palamedes, Nona noticed, was looking curiously rock-like, giving nothing away. Crown said,
Warden, please, we need her.
Yeah, you do, said the prince. I don't come in test tubes, so you can either let me hitch back to the Ninth or you can all come at me together and see if you can draw a single drop of my dead-ass blood. Go nuts! I get a little bit of excitement in my day, whatever happens.
Camilla twitched forward and the prince saw her. She grinned.
Yeah, that's the spirit, she said. Come on, Cam, you're still mostly alive, right? Here, look, I'll make it easy on you.
She rolled up one sleeve and stuck the bare forearm out in front of her, fist clenched, steady.
Try it. I'm ready for my shot, Doc.
Camilla stepped forward more deliberately, keeping her eyes on the prince's eyes. Palamedes said,
For heaven's sake, Nav, lay off the grandstanding.
But Camilla took the prince's wrist, positioned the needle and pushed the syringe decisively home. The needle snapped in half, like she'd jabbed it into the tiled floor. Camilla staggered back as if this had thrown her off balance. Kiriona Gaia opened her hand, moved it to steady Camilla's shoulder, then, like she was flinching, roughly shoved her away. Camilla fell back into Palamedes's arms. The prince stared at them. Her eyes weren't like Nona's at all now. They were hard and dead and bright, like something that had been dug up.
My father has made my body's bones denser than titanium plex, said the crown prince coldly. My father has made my skin turn away bullets. I am the perfect sword hand and the final expression of the art of the Nine Houses. Don't you get it? I am the Emperor's construct,
Pyrrha said.
Shame he didn't get some spackle for your extra holes, right?
Those are my speed holes. They help me go fast, said Kiriona quickly.
Then Kiriona looked over at Camilla, and the red splotch on Cam's bandages, and her crooked mouth screwed up, and she said,
You're seriously going to end up like me if you keep fucking around.
Camilla said, Nav, what would have happened if I'd gotten that sample?
What? Used a sharper needle?
No dice. My blood burns up outside my body.
Turns to ash, said Kiriona. You need to preserve it to get it out. You know, like impregnate it with thallergy to stop the short-term thanergy reaction. When it reacts with air, the preservation, like, rolls backward. It's not static.
When she looked at Palamedes' face, she laughed again.
Come on, boy! I'm Gideon version two! I know up to 5 necromancy facts now.
For some reason, it was this that made Palamedes look as though he'd been slapped. Ianthe Nibirius' face screwed up briefly. Then he shook himself clear and he said,
If Blood of Eden knows you're up and walking, Gideon, they're going to handcuff you in about 16 different places. How do you feel about that?
Kiriona turned her body to look at them. Nona couldn't quite believe that they couldn't all see it.
But they weren't watching, goggle-eyed. They hadn't even seemed to notice.
It was in Kiriona's every movement, the bright, swift flexions of her arms, and the way she swung her legs, big and brash, and the weirdly easy, light grace with which she moved her dead body. Nona had never seen anyone so sad in her whole short life. It made her nearly afraid to die.
Nobody locks me up anywhere, said Kiriona.
26.
The commander had not brought along Pash's truck with the grill. They had packed everyone into one of the big people-moving trucks with the seats that faced the sides, the kind you saw mercs riding in around the city, but with a cover so that nobody could see inside. It was a dark and blueless night. Thick clouds had gathered over the tops of the buildings, an unusual amount of atmosphere. It made everything sticky and hot and awful. "And now the deluge," Weesuffer said, in as close to a good mood as Nona had ever seen her. Pyrrha had the corpse prints over her shoulder. Kiriona Gaia was very good at playing dead, Nona had to admit. Completely limp and believable. It was a good thing, too. Even in her good mood, Weesuffer did not like it when the body of Ianthe Nibirius turned up, even once Palamedes explained. Nor did Weesuffer want to put Kiriona Gaia in the same truck as them. "Eggs, basket," was all she would say. Palamedes was forced to relent. Nona was strangely relieved that she wouldn't have to ride with the prince, or have to look at her, even if the prince was playing dead. The moment Weesuffer saw Camilla, she called a Blood of Eden medic over, who declared they could not do better on the dressing, but immediately gave Camilla quite a lot of drugs. Camilla had tried to say, "No pain meds," but Palamedes said briskly, "Every pain medication you have, please." Nona had never seen Camilla so meek or malleable. It was like all the time she had ever seen Camilla happy, all at once. When Weesuffer had declared that the body had to be kept apart, Camilla said instantly, "I'll ride with it." Pyrrha said, "No, I will." But Cam said, "No, you stay with Nona." Nona thought this was a bit cruel. "Don't you want to stay with Palamedes?" Camilla and Palamedes in the handsome, nice-haired body that smiled in a much nicer way than it had ever smiled for Ianthe Nibirius, looked at each other. They had not moved much more than an arm's length apart since Palamedes had fought for rights to the body and won. Amazingly and fearfully, Cam looked at Nona and winked. "We need some space," she said. "I'm getting sick of him." "Not surprised," said Palamedes, and they parted with nothing more than Cam leaning forward to touch his forehead to hers again very briefly. So the prince and Camilla got their own truck. They were only two trucks in a cavalcade of people-moving trucks, and theirs and the corpse prince's and Cam's were the middle ones, and theirs didn't seem very full at all. The moment an unmasked, wild-eyed Pash hopped out of the truck to pull the ramp down for Pyrrha, she had looked at the corpse of Kiriona Gaia and said in the loudest possible voice, "Ah, fuck no!" and gone to sit in the farthest corner of Nona's truck instead. Commander Weesuffer sat in the centre with a headpiece and a flip-top computer, and Nona crowded in next to Pyrrha and Palamedes. Palamedes sat next to Crown, and Crown had laid the captain down across three seats. The captain wasn't looking very good, but she wasn't saying anything. Palamedes had checked up on her, looked at her eyes and listened to her breathing as Crown watched, chewing on her littlest fingernail. In the end, she said, "Is there nothing you can do, Master Warden?" "Not in this body." Palamedes levered open the captain's jaw. Nona craned her head to watch, knowing it was nosy but not caring, and noticed that the captain's tongue was bluish and purplish and swollen. He said, "She's suffering micro-seizures. I'm worried about her brain," Crown said urgently. "Master Warden, please, she's come so far and fought so hard." "Let's trust her to fight a little harder," said Palamedes, and he rolled the captain onto her side. He tilted her head down a little and threaded a strap across her middle. "Make sure she doesn't choke." Meanwhile, Pyrrha kept twisting her neck to look at Pash, of all people, scowling maskless in the corner. Nona was desperate for Pyrrha not to do anything stupid like flirt with her. She really thought Pash would do something awful to her kneecaps if she tried, and if that happened, Nona knew she would throw up. It had been a very long day already.
We suffer, said to Palamedes.
The shuttle?
Secure, said Palamedes,
which Nona thought was a flawless way of telling the absolute truth.
I have left my most trustworthy guards at the barracks. Tell them not to explore. Prince Ianthe Nibirius left behind wards and necromantic traps. I have control of this body, but I can't do anything about any nasty surprises she prepared for us, said Palamedes. We suffer, said.
You know that we would neutralize your people, not kill them.
I think they've been neutralized long enough,
Crown said. There are fewer than 20 cohort soldiers left in there, ma'am. They're not in good shape. They may well kill themselves rather than be taken in by Blood of Eden forces, especially if my sister isn't there to help. Their morale will break. Please wait. And Palamedes said,
Tell me everything. Where is the 6th House oversight body?
I have the good news and the neutral news, said Commander, we suffer. Mervwing has been forthcoming, in their own way. Your people are being held underground, being moved constantly from place to place to avoid detection. The tunnels, you see, a lawless and dangerous area, but Unjust Hope has perfected his art of hiding in the most dangerous places, and he always was fond of the mobility doctrine.
How many underground sites, began Palamedes, but Nona's neck had gone stiff of its own accord. Her short-term memory, never very good, had developed a sharp picture in her head. She could hear a high, frightened voice saying, Fucking nuts, man, fucking nutter! She could taste little green fruits.
Multiple. The tunnels underground are both extensive and very unsafe. Collapses, you see. My people have refined the search to 4 possible locations, but you desire thoroughness, swiftness, and the safety of your people. I offer you 2 out of 3, and it is more likely 1.5.
Palamedes said irascibly, Are you telling me that Blood of Eden locked them all in a truck and drove them around the city, this entire time?
Classic Blood of Eden move, said Pyrrha. Fucking insane, surprisingly effective, relies on a lot of soldiers pissing in a lot of bottles.
Our Lady of the Passion made a sound that to Nona was unmistakably a laugh, and obviously hated herself for this so much that she curled up into her seat and glared all around at everyone. Palamedes said,
Make it safe and swift. We are very short on time.
We suffer, moved aside the flip-top computer and crossed her long legs. She was wearing trousers with lots of pockets, but she sat as though she were wearing something much prettier. In the olden days, Nona would have immediately commenced practicing how to sit like that and been able to do it perfectly the first time round. But now she looked at the commander with her elegant older face and she felt a great hot pang inside her, some kind of sorrow related to legs.
That will involve sending my people in on lightweight vehicles, cycles and whatnot, in small groups through the service tunnels. They may cover a lot of ground and not draw attention from drivers. The problem being that the service tunnels do not cover all the ground. There is a risk in each area that we would miss Mervwing's trucks entirely. We might count one area as clear and find ourselves mistaken.
Pyrrha said.
Who worked this out? What's the estimated success rate?
Crown plucked one of the clipboards from We Suffer's pile, and the commander pointed to certain areas. Crown said,
Different for each site. 57%, 40%, 32%. Commander, these numbers are worthless. If you want heavy vehicles in the tunnels, I cannot assure you that Mervwing will not liquidate the asset. Unjust Hope is not having a good night, and he may assume he will never have another good night ever again.
Palamedes asked,
Is there no way to make those numbers better?
Listen, you snivelling jackshit, said Pash.
Nona was glad Cam wasn't there.
You sound like every admin suit there ever was. Can we make the numbers better? Oh, yeah, sure. Let me pull the good numbers out of my fucking asshole where I stashed them for safekeeping. These are the best numbers you're going to get.
I really, really hate to say this about Pash, said Crown, but she's right, Warden.
Thank you, fuck you, said Pash.
Pyrrha looked at her again, and Pash made a big harumph and looked away.
Apologies. I did sound like I was at Resource Committee, Palamedes admitted.
All of a sudden, the captain made a horrible gurgling sound. It sounded weirdly like guttural laughter. Her feet twitched, and Crown held her down and checked her over until the loudest sound was the captain's breathing. Nona cleared her throat, then cleared it again, just in case.
I know where the convoy was earlier this week, she suggested.
Every single head turned to look at her, even Pash's, and she felt hot in the face, and she said indignantly,
I do, or my friend saw it, and it had a bunch of people in it with white eyes, like they couldn't see, except they could see, and then Honesty got his face smashed. Ask the Angel, they'll tell you I'm not lying.
To say that Commander We Suffer looked astonished would have been an understatement.
Are you certain?
You've been talking about the convoy,
Nona said eagerly, pleased to have any sign of encouragement.
We all know about them, or at least my gang does, at school. Honesty went down there to make money by stealing air conditioning systems, but it ended badly, and he says he'll stick to drugs.
But this is a story being told by, what, a child? A teenager? About some other person who says they saw some people in a truck. Is your friend to be trusted?
Nona dithered.
I don't think he was lying this time, she said. Really? Seriously, ask the Angel. I mean, ask AIM.
The commander put her flip-top computer in Crown's arms and stood up. She kept her balance using the swaying handholds at the top of the truck, and she turned her face away from Nona so that Nona could not see what she was saying, which made hearing and understanding nearly impossible. While she was talking, a muffled crack, boom of thunder sounded overhead, then another softer crack, boom, followed by long whistles like something breaking a far-off sound barrier. Pash said,
Missile launcher?
Wrong sound, said Pyrrha.
The commander turned around.
Nona, she said, would your friend Honesty tell us the exact location where he saw the trucks?
Even in the circumstances, Nona had to laugh.
No, never. Honesty says never tell anything to anyone in uniform.
Would he tell you?
Nona felt very grave.
If you had asked me that yesterday, she said, I would have said probably yes, because Honesty's my friend, but Hot Sauce shot me when she found out I was a zombie, so I'm out of the gang.
Ah, children. They are very forgiving, said the commander, proving to Nona she had never been around children.
She said into her receiver,
The messenger will tell you the street. Split us off and take us there.
Pyrrha leant over.
Do you want me to go with you, Junior?
But Nona knew that she couldn't take Pyrrha either. It just wouldn't work.
No, she said drearily. At least, I want you to, but you can't. At least if Honesty tries to hit me, she reasoned, cheering herself up, I can do one of my horrible screams. That'd impress him.
A hard wind had whipped up when they dropped Nona outside the decrepit building where Honesty lived. Pash jumped out of their idling truck, and so had several other Blood of Eden soldiers bristling with guns. Nona felt very vulnerable, ducking up the rickety stairs. The wind suddenly blew upward so hard as she mounted the second staircase that she thought she would fall backward and off, but she pulled herself along doggedly. It seemed to her that her entire brain now lived somewhere in her forehead. Her body knew it was tired, but it was as though someone else were feeling it, or maybe that she weren't feeling it at all. Honesty lived in what had used to be a utility room, so it didn't have any numbers on the door. Honesty always said he found that comforting, staying in an unlisted apartment. She hammered on the door, and when nobody answered, she despaired. She hammered again and hissed desperately,
Honesty! It's me! Let me in!
There was still no sound from within. What if Honesty had gone out? But then the door cracked on a rusted chain, and a watery blue eye was visible in that seam between door and frame, and she heard his familiar hoarse voice.
Nona! Honesty, please let me in, she said. I can't! Will you talk to me then, just here at the door?
His eye flashed one way, then another. He said more conversationally.
I mean, it's not like I don't want to, Nona, but you've got to understand, it's that... Well, you see...
Nona knew immediately and was miserable. You've talked to Hot Sauce.
Is it true? Said Honesty. Are you a zombie?
Even if I said I wasn't, would you go against Hot Sauce?
Hell no, said Honesty.
Good, said Nona. I would think less of you if you did, you know, Honesty, because even if I'm not in the gang anymore, I want you to know I think it's important to believe Hot Sauce first. Honesty looked backward and forward again, his pale eye roving restlessly over her and her surrounds.
You've cut your hair, he said.
Camilla did it.
It makes you look mean as...
I know, Nona sorrowed.
It'll grow back. Maybe, said Honesty, cautiously. If you can push a bullet out your head, your hair's probably okay. What do you want, anyway?
It's the convoy, she said, wringing her hands. I need to know where you saw them. What street you went down when you went on that job with the convoy. Honesty, for he had tried to shut the door on her. Honesty, this is a matter of life. The chain rattled and the door hesitated.
You're supposed to say, and death, he supplied.
I have started to not believe in the other one, said Nona. It's stupid saying, and death, where most of the people who die get up and walk around again. Maybe if I said, a matter of life and double death. Honesty said,
how about life and death where you don't come back?
That's so long, said Nona. Honesty, please tell me the name of the street and I'll go away. I'll go away forever, I think. And I want you to know that if I go away forever and you go into the building and someone lets you into my room, I want you to have all the coins in my ceramic fish. And if you check at school, they keep my old wiping rag in the desk. Honesty said,
what the hell would I want with your old wiping rag?
Sometimes they put drops of turpentine on it, and you might be able to sell it to get someone high, said Nona pitifully.
The door closed in her face.
Nona felt like a failure. But before she could try again, stave the door in with a good solid shove, hoping that she wouldn't wimp out at the last moment, it opened again. It wasn't Honesty. It was Hot Sauce. Honesty was right there behind her shoulder, saying mulishly,
I don't care! I don't care! She's always going to be my friend, boss. I won't ditch a girl like that, a girl who thinks of my business like that. I'd go into business with a girl like that, boss, okay?
But Nona had no eyes for him. Nona stood on the threadbare, filthy carpet and looked at Hot Sauce. And Hot Sauce looked at her. Her heart trembled in her throat.
Come in. Sit down, said Hot Sauce.
Nona sat down on one of Honesty's chairs, which consisted of a big square of cardboard on the floor. Hot Sauce sat on another. Nona drew her knees up to her chest and said,
I can't stay, so please don't shoot me because it'll take up time.
Don't shoot her anyway, said Honesty. Bullets is expensive.
Hot Sauce ignored him and said,
are you going away?
Yes, said Nona. So are the other necromancers, zombies. I guess there won't be any more here for a while.
There'll always be more necromancers.
I suppose, eventually, said Nona, feeling wet and depressed.
Honesty had spread the map that had hung in the classroom out on his sleeping bag.
Nicked it,
he said, to Nona's quizzical glance. He was following something with his finger.
He said, give me a moment.
Then he said,
there, 'cause that's the alley where the winos were. It's the only one that ends in the triangle.
Hot Sauce said without looking,
write it down, idiot. You know Nona can't do written stuff, boss. It's not for her. Fine. I'll print, he added generously. My joined-up writing's too sophisticated to read.
Hot Sauce and Nona were left together. Nona kept stealing glances at Hot Sauce, at her closed-off, silent face, with its ridges like strange waves on the sea. Hot Sauce met her gaze levelly, and Nona said,
Will you tell Born in the Morning and Beautiful Ruby and Kevin I love them? You don't have to say yes or no, but think about it, please. And will you tell the nice lady teacher I'm sorry that I had to leave work, but at least I didn't die at the water treatment plant, and if they get a new teacher's aide, they have to be specially nice to the tinies. It's not their fault they're small.
Hot Sauce said,
The angel?
Nona swallowed.
The angel's important, Hot Sauce.
Well, said Hot Sauce, we knew that.
Honesty said,
Finished!
And he folded up the bit of paper, and he deposited it in Nona's waiting hands. Nona immediately shoved it into her pocket, in case the wind wanted to blow it away. Honesty said,
Don't get involved in the convoy, you know what, Nona? That shit's creepy.
Nona decided not to tell Honesty that the convoy was probably full of zombies.
Don't you take jobs like that again, she said. There's lots in my ceramic fish, okay?
She scrambled to her feet and brushed some of the wetter cardboard off her black trousers. Hot Sauce also rose to stand.
Hot Sauce always stood so beautifully,
and she walked Nona to the door, which took 2.5 steps. Nona looked at Hot Sauce. She was terribly afraid she was about to cry, but then she burst out,
Hot Sauce! Why are you called Hot Sauce?
Hot Sauce blinked at her.
You really want to know? She said. Yes, said Nona. Yes, yes, terribly yes.
Hot Sauce looked up at the chipped ceiling of Honesty's apartment, then down at the carpet, and then at Nona.
Because I really like it, she admitted.
What?
You can put it on anything, said Hot Sauce. Spicy food's always better. You can put it on rice, but you can also put it on bread.
Nona reached out. She wrapped her arms around Hot Sauce. She whispered,
Hot Sauce, forgive me. Forgive me so I can know what it feels like.
Hot Sauce was as still as a statue in Nona's arms. Then she gently perambulated Nona toward the door, bumped her gently over the threshold, looked her dead in the face.
We're cool,
she said, and awkwardly.
I'll always love you, Nona.
Nona found that huge tears were dripping out of her eyes, making it hard to see Hot Sauce.
Can I be in the gang again? She whispered.
Hot Sauce wavered.
Yes, she said. But you're on Kevin bathroom duty forever for being a zombie. That's fair.
And she shut the door.
27. The thundercracks had increased tenfold, with no rain to be seen. The night had grown so hot that everyone in the big truck had started to sweat. The moment Nona had moistly thrust the note into Wee Suffer's hand, the commander had barked into her headpiece, Go! All units not on barracks duty are now deployed. Inter-wing rules no longer apply. Tessaphone wing cells, repeat. This is cell commander, we suffer and we suffer. We have recommenced operation lock and key. Repeat, we have recommenced operation lock and key. There was a ragged cheer from the drivers and a powerful hoorah from deep in Pash's chest, one hand steadying herself against the rattling car seats as she pulled a pair of tough, rustling overalls up over her day clothes. We Suffer continued. No speeches. All I shall say is, Revenge is a dish best served ice cold. Cells, Suftinger, Zoa, Birmingham, Troya, Maputo, Tari, proceed. Memphis, Taxa, Calakmul, Valencia, Opava, Dundee, proceed. There was an aerial screech far overhead, another long whistling crack of something atmospheric. The commander levered her headset away from her face, sighed nigh hysterically, and said,
I never thought her operation would begin afresh by extracting houses from another Blood of Eden wing, and yet it is unmistakably the first step.
Pyrrha said.
It's not one she would have taken.
We suffer looked at Pyrrha inquiringly, tapping her fingers on one knee.
I have noticed you love to make these statements, she said. Commander Wake might have said this. Commander Wake would have thought that. I have come to the conclusion that you are not simply trying to annoy me and others like me, but I have no idea what you are doing otherwise.
Next to Nona, Pyrrha gave an ineloquent shrug.
Maybe I just like talking to other people who knew her. And should they wax so nostalgic with you, her murderer?
Pyrrha was unmoved.
I like to think I knew her as well as anyone else, Commander. As well as anyone could know her.
Pash viciously snapped shut the clasps on her trousers and pulled a vest over her head, putting her brightly dyed hair into complete disarray.
Say one more word on this fucking subject and I swear to all fuck I'll do for you.
Pyrrha said,
Wake had your photo, you know. She kept it on her.
When Pash's head whipped around, Nona could see that this had shaken her badly. Her bird's beak features had all scrunched together toward the front, as though clustering for safety, and this made her scars zigzag up her forehead and her nose. She said,
Oh, shut your mouth!
But there was a desperate note to it.
Knew it the moment I saw you. What were you, 9, 10?
We suffer, said.
Lichter, Dve, I ask you to stop. From one alive human to another, more or less so.
But Pash was saying quickly.
Let her. She's bullshitting. Con artist stuff.
This might be my only chance to say this, said Pyrrha comfortably. And I'm seriously nicotine-deprived, which makes me sentimental. You're the kid in that photo.
She kept it folded up in her pliers case. You're holding an automatic 3 sizes too big for you, right? One of your front teeth is gone. She holds up that photo to me and she goes,
If it wasn't for filth like you, nice kids like this wouldn't have to hold these.
Pash's throat was working. Pyrrha continued.
I mean, I was all, I'd buy this a lot more if you weren't so obviously proud as hell. And she only laughed in that mean-ass way she always laughed and said, That's my submachine gun she's holding.
Pash closed her eyes. Nona held her breath. But Pash wasn't mad or upset. She looked as though she were having a religious experience.
I remember asking if you really were a nice kid, Pyrrha said. She said, No, she's my flesh and blood. She takes after me. After that, I kept thinking about you for a long time.
Sister?
Pash swallowed once.
Twice. 3 times.
No, my mother was her sister, she said gruffly, and not that it means shit to you, wizard. If you're lying to me, I swear.
Palamedes said mildly,
You know we're conversant with the concept of family in the Nine Houses, right?
Pash seemed genuinely surprised.
Why the hell would it matter to you?
Then she checked herself and said,
Scratch that. Why the hell would that matter to me? You don't give a fuck about families when you're carving them up.
At a warning glance from We Suffer, Pash scowled expressively. She said,
Well, I'll leave you with this. Fuck you!
And then her vivid blue head disappeared under a helmet, her bright eyes beneath a visor. Nona found a sigh escaping her chest. All her noises seemed to surprise her now. It was as though her body were capable of shocking her by doing things that did not seem connected to Nona. Pyrrha reached over and touched her hand gently and said,
How are you holding up?
Before Nona could answer, there was another high-pitched whistle, far closer to them now, outside their truck, shockingly close, and a dull thud and a huge pattering of stone. The truck screeched to a halt, then lurched forward again, and everyone inside held onto their seats as the truck
duped left. It said quite a lot about life in the city, that nobody really freaked out about this the first time, nor the second time, nor even the third time, when they heard yelling coming from the front of the truck. Weesuffer's headset crackled to life, and she brought it back down to her mouth.
"Report," she said, then,
"Pardon?" Pyrrha stood, swaying with the swerving movements of the truck, and picked her way along the handholds to the back where the cover had been lashed down tight. There was a clear window of soft plastic you could look through, so long as you didn't want to see much or clearly. It would have been bad looking out of it during the day. At night, with a lot of the streetlights gone, it was basically impossible. Over the headset, Weesuffer said, short and clipped,
"Keep us together. Do not reroute either package. Do not engage. Take the first off-ramp you can find and get us underground."
Pyrrha had gotten a long look out the window. She suddenly squatted down, working at the pegs that kept the cover tight at the back. A corner flapped free and slapped violently at itself, letting in gusts of hot, muggy night air, which, in that space, felt like a breeze. Strong yellow lights from the headlights of the truck behind strobed over them all. Palamedes moved to clamp his arm around Nona's, and Nona held onto her seat and the armrests tightly as Pyrrha leant out. The truck behind them honked an alarm and stared out at the street. When she leant back in, Nona was profoundly upset by her body. Pyrrha was so sinewy and tough, and she was so calm. Unbunched, unhurried, unaffected by most things, sweet and slouchy and always the least afraid person in the room, even if that room had Cam in it. But now she looked at Palamedes and Nona with her deep dark eyes, and she had an expression Nona hadn't seen there before.
"Sextus," she said. "Game over, I'm afraid."
An air siren was wailing, the one they only used in the rainy season to announce a problematic amount of waves or water. Palamedes looked at Pyrrha and said crisply,
"It's not?" "It must have retracted a while ago," said Pyrrha. "We never could have got out of here in the shuttle, no way, no how. The first wave is here."
Weesuffer said,
"No planet killer has attacked a planet like this in my lifetime or in the lifetimes of any of my superiors. Number 7, Varun the Eater, always was lively," said Pyrrha. "But after killing my necromancer, I'd assumed the damn thing would go dormant for a good century. That's how it was after it ripped apart Cassiopeia."
"Is it after the Lictor?" Weesuffer said urgently. "If we neutralized that body, then..." Palamedes held out his hands helplessly. "If it were responding to the soul of Ianthe Nibirius, wouldn't it have responded days ago? From what I gather, it doesn't take a resurrection beast that long to spin up. The slow part is getting in position, and it's been in position for months."
"It doesn't matter why. There's heralds out there," said Pyrrha impatiently. "If number 7's blown, it's blown. We need a Lictor to lead it away, a fully instantiated, experienced, serious Lictor who'd need a start point halfway across the galaxy, preferably with 2 other Lictors to engage it in the river. And if we had all that, we'd hope to God it rerouted the heralds the moment it found better prey. You want Cyrus, Augustine, Cassiopeia. You want Gideon the First, and Gideon the First is dead. He's not coming back." "Oh, God, Gideon," said Pyrrha suddenly. "Gideon, gee, you died for nothing."
Suddenly, the captain started violently trembling. Crown immediately moved to hold the captain's hands away from her face, said in low tones,
"Come on. Come on, Deutros. I'm here. Fight this, goddamn you. Stay awake and fight."
And the captain made a noise like, Nona made her body stand on its 2 feet.
2 feet. The worst number for feet. Not so many that they were ever useful, not so few that you didn't have to think about them.
She walked to the end of the truck and stood where the wheels burred beneath her.
and she pushed Pyrrha aside. Pyrrha fell back flat on her back on the bottom of the truck, and she was sorry immediately, but she didn't have time, and she stood in front of Crown and she held out her hand.
"Sword," she said.
Crown said falteringly,
"Nona?"
She took too long. Nona took her sword. She had to use her hands to bend Crown back, enough to get at the scabbard. It wouldn't pull free. It was at the wrong angle, so she cut it out of its scabbard. The blade parted the scabbard and came out. It was very heavy on her wrist and dragged a little on the truck floor with a bright, awful screeching. There was a gun trained on her. Pash had jumped to her feet. We suffer were saying, "Pashan, do not shoot," and Palamedes was saying in the other body, "Nona, stop, Nona, talk to me." And it was too much. Nona had to get out. She pushed the flap aside. The truck behind them honked again, and she found the side of the truck with her hand. It was too hard to climb with the sword in her other hand. She needed two. So she sheathed it in her hip, making sure it wedged in firmly. Some of the shirt went with it, but it came out the other side. Nona was glad it was someone else's shirt instead of her salt chip fish shop shirt. She wasn't able to think on her love for her salt chip fish shop shirt. She had clambered up to the top of the truck and was standing there, in the hot, wet blast of the wind and the night, with the truck roaring down the street, fishtailing occasionally. And she could see everything. There was a rain of blobs falling out of the sky. They were shaped like teardrops, twirling crazily as they drove through the atmosphere, lodging themselves in buildings and in the road and in the tops of cars, coming down with an almighty splatter of thick grey mucus. Within these blobs, trembling, the truck was going too fast, Nona saw a thick pod thing, like the miniature sleeping bags worms made for themselves before they bust out as moths. The pods and the mucus were transparent, wreathed in smoke, and there were irregular shapes inside. Irregular and shivering shapes. And some of the pods had wings poking through, flexing, pushing. Nona looked at the truck ahead, which was about one truck length away, and the truck behind, which was about one truck length behind. She walked forward to stand on the hard-shell driver's cabin, and with a little run-up, she jumped forward and sailed through the distance to land on the truck in front. This hurt her feet briefly. It also hurt the thin metal shell on top of the truck, which dented. She looked up at the sky and she bellowed,
"You said you wouldn't do anything weird!"
Nona unsheathed her sword from herself and nearly wept from fury. She put both her hands on the hilt. She did not know how to hold a sword, and she didn't care. She could see the broad main drag, with the fisheries off to one side and the harbour far beyond. Her eye, desiring the familiar, looked to where the building probably was. Her home, a little grey block among the other grey blocks. The truck made a sudden left turn, veering. The trucks were the only vehicles on the road, but big seething pods had splattered onto the asphalt, and the trucks were having to drive around them. Nona stared around herself as the things kept twirling out of the sky like huge and terrible drops of rain, made hard landings on the buildings or on the road or soft landings thudding into the far-off ocean. She could hear yelling, glass breaking, screaming, and the air siren all at once. Nona turned around. On the truck she had emerged from, someone was now standing where she had stood, on top of the driver's cab. It wore tattered old trousers and a thin old shirt, and it was the captain. The captain opened her mouth and said, "Get him! Get him! Get him! He flees!"
"I can't," said Nona. "I can't do anything. I don't want to do anything."
The captain moaned sharply.
"All for nothing. You asked for help. You asked. And all for nothing. Only pain. You asked. I gave you blood for blood."
Nona, grief-stricken, hollered,
"Not like this. I love this place."
Do you love? Said the captain's mouth. Nona struggled.
Yes. No, yes, she said. Then, I don't know what it means. I say it, and I don't know what it means. Did I ever know what it meant?
Green thing, said the captain. Green and breathing thing. Big ghost, the drinker, transformed. What will you eat now? Where will your body go? What did he do to you to make you this way? You eat yourself. I gorge on unliving marrow.
It was true. The captain looked as though she were withering before Nona's eyes. She cried out in haste,
Don't! Stop that! I can't stop it, but you can stop it! Stop hurting her! She doesn't know what you're doing!
You cry mercy, said the captain.
Yes, mercy, yes, said Nona.
I have crossed the face of the universe, said the captain. I poison it to match my grief.
Yes, said Nona, but stop this! Stop hurting the captain!
She rooted around wildly to find a phrase and fell back on Cam.
You're acting out. Maybe you should take 5.
For 8,000 unjust bodies I will stop, said the captain.
Nona said,
No, I want you to stop now.
They concoct their own vengeance, said the captain. Their justice is not my justice. Their water is not my water. I came to help. I am made a mockery. The danger is upon you, and you do not even know. They are coming out of their tower, salt thing. There is a hole at the bottom of their tower. I will pull their teeth. I will make it blank for you.
Nona said,
Hot sauce never did anything wrong, or beautiful Ruby, or born in the morning, or Kevin, and honesty.
Here she was compelled by the truth.
Honesty doesn't know any better. Camilla and Palamedes never did anything wrong. Pyrrha says she did a lot wrong, but at least she knows it. And we don't like the captain, but we pity her. Stop hurting the captain. Don't do this.
And Nona found herself saying,
I'm ready to die. Really ready.
Nothing is really ready to die, said the captain.
Nona took a running leap as the truck rounded another corner. She misjudged. She bounced off the side of a building like a ball. She came to a rolling stop in front of the captain and knocked her down, and they both fell together. Nona looked at the captain's face with its closed eyes, still wasted but not dead, and looking a little less like a piece of fruit someone had sucked all the juice out of. Nona lay on her back atop the stretched canvas, and Nona's mouth said,
Just wait. Just help me. Help me do this. I might be different. Soon.
The big dark shapes were still twirling out of the sky, silently it seemed, although there were mismatched boom cracks distantly resounding at the very tops of the tall buildings. Nona watched them anxiously. The sky was so thick with them. But were they thinning? Were fewer falling? Nona stared up at the sky. She felt movement next to her. The captain was looking at her, eyes open. Normal eyes. The whites covered in little red spindles from where the veins had burst. The ring around the iris deeply black. The iris deeply brown. One of her hands was clasped to the back of her neck as though it hurt her.
Harrow Hark, said the captain doubtfully.
Nona looked up at the sky. She was very tired, or at least there was a tiredness happening to her. A huge neighbouring exhaustion that lived, when she sought it, beneath her neck. It was hard understanding how her body fit together. She had to deliberately think about its different parts when she wanted to feel a sensation. She closed her eyes.
No,
she finally admitted. And I never was.
John 1:20. In the dream, they breached what he called the reception area and were confronted with a series of long corridors. At intervals, down the hallway, were more tidal heaps of furniture and stone and bones.
but the bones had been moved by the water and settled far away from where they had originally fallen. Bones and bodies and parts of bodies. He lingered by them and he said, "Those shitty fucking barricades," and caressed the edges of desks and broken chairs. There were huge black scorch marks on everything, fragments of metal and bone embedded in the walls, pock marks everywhere, little round holes. It was barely traversable. After a while he hesitated, and some of the bones got up. They assembled themselves into wet, splinterous heaps. Chips flew out of the walls and out of the water, and they were perfect again, softly white and glowing in the darkness. They scrambled past him and her and started clearing a path. A slow way to do it, but he didn't seem to mind. He said, "We couldn't get anywhere near political conferences anymore, physical or online, but the guy I was walking around was still invited, so I got in for free. He was my eyes and ears. Nobody was arguing about the FTL plan at that point. Wave one was in place and getting ready for final international inspections. They were all arguing about us, how to deal with us. Who should deal with us? Always thought it was funny when I had to puppet my guy into doing speeches about how his government thought I should be brought to justice. I didn't mind." He said, "What I did mind was the fucking state of the first wave of evacuee ships. I saw the inspection reports, I saw the questions about second wave logistics, about exactly who was getting to ride those ships out of here. None of them could pass any kind of muster. See, back in our headquarters, we thought the worst they would do was set up some kind of fucking pay-for-preference system to get the richest bastards out first, and save everyone else for second wave, maybe third. I can't believe how naive I was. It was Em who came to me one night looking like she'd seen a fucking ghost. Apparently, A's little brother and her nun had been obsessing over bank movements and assets, going crazy checking manifests. Em said, 'I've worked out what they're doing. I've worked out the plan. I thought they'd merely make people pay to see who got to jump the queue. But there is no queue.' She said to me, 'John, there is no second wave. There is no third. They're escaping. The trillionaires have converted everything to material resources. Half these passenger manifests are made up. These aren't real people. They've fucked everyone, even the governments. There'll be one single ship of internationals who think they're on wave one to Tau Ceti, and everyone else will be corporate, or have bought a ticket, or be useful. They're leaving us to die.' I had to have her breathe into a bag for a while because she hated it when I tried to fix her anxiety attacks with necromancy. When she could talk, I was just all, 'Are you sure?' She said, 'John, there they go.' And I said, 'Not as long as I have breath in my body.'" At this point, the skeletons had freed some debris from an entryway, and they could both get through. It led to an equally tumble-down, fire-smoked wreck that had not been improved by spending a few weeks underwater. More bodies everywhere, lots of them still with meat on their bones. Another assemblage of furniture and a big cracked table with more holes in it. He said, "God, this kitchen's fucked." He stepped over bodies as his skeletons fought him a path toward a set of cupboards, and he squatted in front of them and opened a cupboard, and more fetid water came out. She was feeling lightheaded by then. Eventually he returned with his arms full of cans, saying, "Hey, peaches in syrup." He did not seem to know how to open the can. One of his skeletons came over, and he fused their finger bones into a kind of saw, and he sawed through the top of the can. In that dank and awful room, they ate peach halves together, slippery and yellow and squashy, with their fingers. They were so sweet she stopped tasting them after the first bite, but they made her feel better. After half a can of peaches, he stopped and said,
"Our last chance was to talk to our government, tell them everything we knew. It wasn't like they'd stopped listening, but we got the impression that they couldn't listen to us unless we all came in with our hands up."
He said,
"We never should have talked to them at all. What we said spooked someone who told someone else, and word got through to the fucking FTL project, who started moving like their asses were on fire. The timeline changed. We were down to days, not months. Our intel said they were getting their people on board, setting up the elevators to get to the orbital launcher, which we were told was fully operational. I was going to have to physically stop those ships from launching. Problem was, they were launching from multiple platforms, and I didn't know if I could stop every single one. C had been saying, 'Can't we gin up some kind of miracle? John, can't you do an act of good wizardry? Any way to stabilize the North American glacier? Any way to trap atmosphere over the Northern Territory? Show them we can fix things here.' But A said, 'That's for later. First things first, bum-rush the ships, pull the bastards out, make them do the cryo plan instead. Get the population safely out and we can stay behind and clear the planet, if John's up for it.' He said, 'I was trying. I was so close to cracking this third thing, the soul. I'd realized there was the energy you produced from being alive and the energy you produced when you died. But the fact that energy was produced when you died meant there was another phase. I could get a corpse's heart beating and get all the neurons firing in the brain, but it wasn't producing the alive stuff anymore. It wasn't an on-off switch. I'd stopped sleeping and I wasn't eating much. I was keeping my body going just by fiddling with the processes.'
He said,
'It made sense that every human had a well of this energy, this soul energy, but I couldn't distinguish it from anything else. Even on the day I'd killed all those cops, there was too much noise and I couldn't work out what the noise was. I could tell it was the thing I was looking for, but I didn't understand why it seemed so big, and I didn't know what to do with it or how to use it. So I said to everyone, 'I can't stop them myself, not yet. We have to stall them. We know they need Pan-Euro's orbital gate access, so let's make sure they can't get it. Let's make sure nobody wants to give them orbital gate access.' He said, and all of us looked at the floorboards. He said, 'None of us wanted to actually nuke anything. But a nuke's good blackmail, right? A nuke adds a lot of pressure, right? The people who knew it was there, they knew that if we talked about having a nuke, everyone would find out who gave us a fucking nuke. So we said to our client, Pan-Euro cannot be allowed to let these people through. They're cutting and running. They're leaving 10 billion people behind to die, having stolen financing and support and materials. They're leaving us to drown.' And we said, 'We don't want to make a scene, but—' They said, 'Okay, okay, but hand the fucking nuke back. We've changed our minds. We'll stop Pan-Euro. We'll put our whole weight into making sure they don't get out of orbit, but we want the bomb back before you do something crazy.' He said, 'They took so long that the ships were counting down to launch. We were about 48 hours away from Wave 1 at that point. A couple of nations were all, "Hang on, this is early, this isn't to schedule," but the FTL project said they were doing a mock run because preparation was going so well. How the hell did anyone buy that? How much money was changing hands? Didn't they realize that if these bastards were giving away insane amounts of cash, it was because they didn't think cash was worth anything anymore?" He said, "So here's us, planning to meet these agents in neutral territory across the ditch over in the huddle where the territory refugees were. They wanted us to pass the nuke back. We all voted to trust them, but A and G and M and I came up with a just-in-case plan. 48 hours became 24 so quickly. G fixed up the case and carried it over alone, with caveats. Nobody liked that. They were all, shit, John, send someone dead, send a puppet. But I wanted G. P volunteered to go with him, but G said he wouldn't arm it if P was in range. P went off at him, but it was one of those times where he held his ground against her. I remember she called him a stupid kid. He said, I had this weird gut feeling before we sent him off on that private plane, and I was getting pretty good at that time, even if I wasn't good enough. I took G downstairs and got him to face the wall, and I took his arm off. He said, he didn't feel any pain, and I grew him a new one then and there. Bit of a gamble, but I was sure I could do that by then. I wanted his arm, his material. He didn't even ask me to explain. That was the kind of guy he was. He and I had grown up on the same street. I'd spotted him for mince pies all the time as kids, so stands to reason he let me cut off his arm and carried a nuke for me.
He added contemplatively,
should still be around here. The arm, I mean. I stuffed it in the morgue so nobody would find it. I've got plans for that arm.
Then he took a moment to eat another bright yellow wedge of peach. After the peach wedge, he said,
where was I? G on his way with a nuke. The ship's on the launch pad. 20 hours to go now. Less. So much waiting around. Me in my bedroom with a nun and a migraine, her thinking that if she pushed me enough, we'd instantiate the Trinity and we'd all be saved. Everyone else drinking. The clock ticking louder than ever before. C admitting out of nowhere she's dating N. All of us like, what? We've known for a year. Go ahead and get married already. We've got a nun. N was all, that's not legal. C, of all people, said, who cares? That's how bad it was.
He said,
C and N got married right over there. You can't see it now because of the rubbish. I made flowers grow for them out of the garden, but they came out weird. Some of the roses had teeth. C and N thought that was hilarious.
He said, the dome meant we hadn't had full sunlight in a while.
It was beautiful anyway. I cried the whole service. I couldn't remember the last time I'd eaten food.
He said, an hour and 42 minutes later, G landed and made his way to the meet-up, and that's when I had to tell everyone that the nuke was armed and G was a dead man's switch. First I told our contacts, then I had to tell C and N and P and everyone.
He said, they went apeshit, which I don't think was entirely fair. I said to them, you think they weren't just going to shoot him first thing? You think there aren't 6 snipers with beads on G right now? But they weren't only aggro about G. They were aggro that a nuke might go off and kill a couple million people. I was like, guys, it's fine, they're Australian.
He said,
wow, talk about jokes with no hope of landing.
He said,
the contacts stayed pretty calm, though. They said, John, we're not doing anything until you dismantle the switch and disarm the bomb. It's not a fair conversation if you have this nuke on the table. Also, you will not be hurting any of us with this suitcase nuke. We are not even sitting in that country, so where would that get you? Who would you be hurting, John? And I said, yeah, I thought about that. They said, did you? I said, yes. On that note, do you remember the dead guy you've mocked up to look alive? The one who still has executive power over your own nuclear codes? The one you gave me total access to? He said, by that time, I had him in position. It was pretty easy. I just made sure that everyone around him wasn't part of the conspiracy, that nobody around could stop me, and I locked the doors. They gave him, me, the codes. I had his finger on the button. I told them, "You have 30 minutes to tell Pan-Euro that there is no way those gates are opening for those ships." They said, "You wouldn't. It would be nuclear war." I said, "I'd do anything. You know I would. Cows exhibit mourning behaviour for other cows." He said, "At this point, my people were like, 'John, what the fuck? What the fuck is happening?' We were all yelling at each other. First time I'd ever seen Sihi angry. Ayn and P were having a go at me too, and the nun and A's hedge fund manager brother had teamed up to try to mediate, which, as per usual, made everyone pissed off at them instead. A and M were on my side, kind of, or at least the side of, 'This will be fine, we can walk this back, nothing's going to happen, right, John?' I was pissed. I told them it would work. N was all, 'It's not going to work. This is going to end with the ships launching and G getting shot, and you're going to kill millions of people for nothing. We followed you to save the world.' I said, 'We're doing that. This is how we save the world. Believe me.' C said, 'John, your problem is that you care less about being a saviour than you do about meting out punishment.' I said, 'C, I was just your best man.' C said, 'You still are. That doesn't change the fact that you can be quite the most appallingly vindictive person I have ever met.' He said, 'Things went from bad to worse. The other side scrambled pretty quickly. Like, what you've got to keep in mind is that we've got hundreds of cultists on both sides of the cow wall, and quite a lot of these guys are one-nation nutbars who think they're going to see out the end of the world in a bunker and live to build a beautiful paradise that looks a hell of a lot like the moon is a harsh mistress. And those guys have illegal semi-automatics. We've still got Wi-Fi, more's the fucking pity. And those guys are talking to their people on the outside, and they flip. So while me and the others are having this massive fight, we get the message that 100 of these guys have changed their minds about us, and they've surrounded the inner building with guns, and we're going down. They've taken a hell of a lot of the other cultists hostage, so if I start killing anyone, the hostages are dead meat." He said, "We kept on yelling at one another, but we mobilized while we yelled, making barricades. I didn't just kill them all. It would have looked completely fucking shitty. And I was trying to win an argument that I didn't solve all my problems with murder. Everything always happens at the worst time. We got everyone in the building on lockdown, using a bunch of procedures we developed in case some of the cryo stuff leaked. Shutters down, fire doors locked remotely, that kind of thing. And we built the barricades. You saw those." He said, "We tried talking to them, saying, 'Wow, this is not the time, be chill.' They didn't listen. A said they'd sold out. I didn't think so. They'd seen me fuck up once, killing the cops. And once people see you do something and come to an opinion about it, there's nothing you can do. People don't forgive, not really. Once they doubt, you've already lost them. That's what was scaring me about the others. Had I already lost my best friends, the only people I needed? I just caught the fucking tooth bouquet at CNN's wedding. What if that didn't matter?" After a moment, he said, "Anyway." The outside force of ex-cultists with guns were trying to force their way in, said they'd open fire if I didn't walk out. And I said, "Okay, do you want me to walk out? Should I go?" And A and M and the others said, "Don't you dare, John." Instead, I sent out a couple skeletons to try to save the hostages. Lot of fighting, lot of confusion. We got some of the hostages inside the building, but then they charged us. We sealed up the hall when they busted through reception. You saw the front doors, right? They had Molotov cocktails. I was all, next cult, let's go for teenage girls instead. Write that down somewhere. M was all, are you kidding? At least with these guys we have a chance of getting out alive. I was still on call with G the whole time. He was holding up well, dealing with a lot of negotiators telling him pretty awful shit. He was immovable. That was why I wanted him in. G only listened to two people in his fucking life. He wasn't going to listen to some white-collar asshole in a Kevlar jacket preaching about cost analysis. I was pretty sure he was safe. They were too scared to do anything to him. I was more freaked out about the guys hammering on the barricades. I couldn't even take them down because I was trying to do 60 fucking things at once. I was walking around a dead politician. I was having 6 conversations with people I was trying to negotiate with while making a barricade out of lawn chairs. And the hour was ticking down and I didn't know what to do anymore. I'd lost my nerve. I didn't know what I was going to do when the hour ran out. I had to admit that to myself. It was taking a lot of effort not to ice everyone within a kilometre, if only to get some fucking peace and quiet. But I figured that'd lose me the moral high ground. He said, they were skirmishing down the hall when I did freak out and lock myself in the bedroom. I didn't let anyone in except Ulysses and Titania, because they wouldn't fight with me. Here, let me take you.
He took her from the kitchen, the can of peaches forgotten. The skeletons moved to clear all the rubble from their path. At one point, they reached a solid mass of bone, and as he approached, it collapsed into dust, so that he was walking through a bad-smelling mist. She followed him. The hallway behind it was clear, no piles of broken furniture or broken walls, but everything was filthy with water. The walls bowed, the lights had been ripped out of their housings, and parts of the ceiling had torn open and revealed big black gaps above the roofing panels. At last, one of the skeletons opened a door so that they could stand on the threshold of a room, just a few steps away from what on first blush looked like a pile of wet brown clothes. So much of what was left looked like wet brown clothes. But there was a body inside those clothes that had not come through the water well. She looked at it, but he didn't. He looked anywhere but at it. He covered his face. He uncovered his face. He looked away. It took him a long time to talk. When he could, he said,
"M and her nun spent a while yelling through the door at me. Well, M was yelling. M kept saying this was too far. She knew I didn't want to do this. I could walk this back. She told me everything could be okay so long as none of those buttons got pushed. She said the ex-cultists had made it as far as the labs. So what were we going to do?" I didn't respond. Eventually M gave up and went away.
He said more dreamily,
"Not much left of the hour. Everyone would have been inside the ships. Everyone would have been in place. They would have been doing last-minute checks. There was G, waiting in the middle of a city centre across the ocean, definitely half a dozen sniper beads on him.